Good morning. I'd like to call to order the May 7th, 2020 meeting of the TPA's Bicycle Trailsways Pedestrian Advisory Committee. Please note that pursuant to the Governor's Executive Order Number 20-69, TPA Operating Procedures Section 6.2, and TPA Emergency Order Number 2020-01, this meeting is being conducted without having a quorum of its members present physically or at any specific location, and utilizing communications media technology instead. For today's meeting, we are utilizing the Zoom webinar platform. Committee members, scheduled presenters, and the TPA's committee liaison will be appearing at today's meeting remotely either via webcam or telephone. Committee members, please note that your microphones are initially set on mute. When you wish to be recognized, please use the raise hand function within the Zoom platform. You should unmute your microphone when you're recognized. Members of the public can join the meeting by installing the free Zoom app and entering the webinar ID and password provided on the agenda. You can also join via web browser at the website provided in the agenda. You can watch a live stream of the meeting at www.palmbeachtpa.org/live. Finally, you can join by phone using the phone number, webinar ID, and password provided on the agenda. Public comments can be submitted online at the website provided in item 1.f on the agenda. Public comments can also be made live through the Zoom webinar platform. When you wish to be recognized, please use the raise hand function within the Zoom platform and then wait to be recognized by the chair and unmuted by the meeting host. Staff, please call the roll so that we can establish that a quorum exists and so that the public will know who is attending this meeting. Committee members, please remember to unmute your microphones prior to responding to your roll call.
I will unmute all just because it was a little bit easier yesterday for that. But again, if you physically muted your phone, you will need to unmute it on your side. Sally Channon. Eric Ferguson.
Here.
Ted Goodenough.
Here.
Michael Howe.
Here.
Jean Matthews is excused. Yash Nagal.
Here.
Fadi Nassar. I don't think it unmuted Fadi. Okay. Michael Owens.
Here.
Craig Pinder.
Here.
Olga Prieto.
Ryan Harding for Olga Prieto.
Brian Ruscher.
Here.
Bob Sabin.
Here.
Joanne Scaria.
Here.
How do you say that? I said that wrong.
That's fine.
Sorry. Stephanie Thoburn.
Garrett Watson here for Stephanie Thoburn.
Larry Wallace.
Here.
We have a quorum, Mr. Chair.
Okay. Motion to adopt agenda for May 7th, 2020. Can I have a motion to adopt the agenda?
I motion it.
Second.
Second.
Okay, we have a motion.
So I have a motion by Ted and a second.
Seconded
by Michael Howe.
Okay.
And then, Margie, are we going to unmute everyone for this, or we have to do a roll call?
For this one, I'm unmuting all, and then okay. It's just a verbal.
A verbal.
Yay or nay.
All in favor, please say aye.
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 Opposed? Okay, there's no opposed, no raised hands. The motion carries to adopt the agenda. Motion, item C, motion to approve minutes for March 5th, 2020. The meeting minutes have been distributed. Are there any changes to the minutes? Okay, I don't see any raised hands. May I have a motion to adopt the minutes as presented?
So moved.
Second.
So I have a motion by Bob, a second by Michael Owens.
Okay. Correct. Motion's been made, properly seconded. All those in favor?
Aye.
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 Opposed? Okay, there's the ayes have it. Okay.
So,
I am
going to mute everybody. So if you do have any comments or questions, please make sure to use the raise hand feature.
I don't see a raised hand feature, but if I just raise my hand up, can you see me?
Yes.
Okay.
Real quick, Bob, do you have the participants on the side?
No, I don't see them at all. The only time I see participants is when they talk.
Okay.
It says the name.
I think we have a workaround, right, Margie, with him if he raises his hand in the video?
Yes. So for Ted, it's easier for him to physically raise his hand. So, Bob, if you want to do that as well, I will be paying attention.
Okay.
All right. Comments from the chair. Just want to thank everyone for attending. This is quite unusual. It's our first Zoom meeting. So have a little patience. I'm really impressed with how TPA staff put this together quickly. The other thing I just briefly mentioned, I know really not a positive about COVID, but one thing I've noticed is there's been DOT published numbers of 30 to 50% reduction in vehicle volume. Anecdotally, I've seen a lot of increased bike and pedestrian activity. So I'm hoping some of these habits stick that the telecommuting and things we've shown that can work. And I hope that after this, some of those habits will last. We may see some changes to our transportation system because of that. So that's all I have. So item E, BTPAC liaison's report. Valerie's going to present the liaison's report.
All right. And actually, speaking of what you were just mentioning, we're actually going to put out a brief survey asking folks about how the COVID-19 situation has changed their travel behaviors and whether or not how they think it'll, after this passes, if it'll stick and if in their community, for themselves and for their workplace. So keep an eye out for that. We'll be sharing that. For our liaison report, I know we didn't meet last month, but I wanted to congratulate the city of Boynton Beach because they passed the resolution to become a Vision Zero city and establish the goal of zero traffic-related fatalities on their roadways. So congratulations to them. Also, you may have heard, but with the current situation, State Road 80 is being accelerated, the widening, and this is in central Palm Beach County. More towards the western side of State Road 80. But the governor declared that he wanted to accelerate critical infrastructure projects throughout Florida due to the reduction in traffic during this situation. So this was one of the projects accelerated. It is about 7.2-mile section of southern from 4 lanes to 6 lanes from west of Lion Country Safari to Forest Hill Crestwood Boulevard. So this has been accelerated by nearly 3 months now, and it started in July 2018, with the goal to be finished by summer of 2021, but now it's going to be accelerated by 3 months. We also wanted to bring to your attention that we recently received a letter from FDOT that they have decided to repeal their 2019 approval of the lane elimination project for South Dixie Highway from Albemarle Road to Okeechobee Boulevard in West Palm Beach. This was one of our priority projects for local initiatives fundings with $7.3 million for construction in next fiscal year. This project has received a lot of local, resistance lately. FDOT has been getting calls and letters from the local residents and businesses in opposition of the project. So they did a reassessment of the traffic study, and because of this opposition, they decided to eliminate this project. We'll see what happens. I believe the city is planning to meet with them and discuss, but currently that's the status of this project. We also found out yesterday that the intersection of Okeechobee Boulevard and Jog Road will be temporarily switched to a one-lane roundabout as a pilot on Saturday, May 16th, as part of a joint Palm Beach County and FDOT hurricane preparedness exercise. So between 6 a.m. and 12 p.m., they'll be testing this out. I think it's really going to be happening for a full 2 hours. The 6 a.m. is kind of the setup, and then so I think it'll be running from 10 a.m. Or from 8 a.m. to 10 a.m. and then set up and tear down before. So we'll see how that turns out. The AARP Community Challenge Grants, these are grants that are to fund quick action projects that help create livable communities for people of all ages and abilities. The deadline to apply for these grants has been extended to May 15th. So if anyone's interested in checking that out or applying, visit aarp.org/community challenge. And then finally, our governing board meeting will be on Thursday, May 29th at 9 a.m. And a final notice of meeting location and how that meeting will be conducted will be sent out a week prior to the meeting. And that concludes my liaison report.
Staff, are there any public comments on this item?
No public comments have been received.
Do any committee members have any comments or questions on the liaison's report? And I'm wondering, putting you on the spot, Bill Thady, I know your department is doing the roundabout temporary traffic control, if you want to add anything. It's a pretty innovative project, so.
No, I mean, nothing at this point.
Any other committee members have comments or questions?
I do have Ted has his hand raised. So okay. I've unmuted you, Ted.
Thank you. I did have a question about the hold on. Sorry, my computer was yapping at me. So this is Jog and Okeechobee that you're doing the roundabout?
Yes, the county and FDOT will be testing an emergency preparedness situation in case of hurricanes when the signals are down to see how a one-lane roundabout would function. So they're going to test that now because traffic volumes are lower. They're going to see how that type of situation would work.
Okay, I appreciate that. I lived in New England for a long time. Roundabouts are not my favorite thing, but and I guess the test being in a time of lower volume, is it actually going to be a viable test if we're all evacuating? Because you go from 20,000 to 50,000 in the test being 20,000 in 2 hours to 50,000 in an evacuation. Are they going to try it at other times so that they can get a better feel for it?
I'm not sure. Fadi, do you have more information on this project? I know we just found out about it yesterday.
I don't have a lot of information on it. I believe it's Rasim who's leading this effort, but I can check and provide some update next time we meet.
Okay. Thank you.
I could provide a little bit of context, Ted. This actually came out of North Carolina's done this, and it's not evacuation, it's meant for post-storm events. Like if the traffic signal was completely damaged and we didn't have power for a couple weeks, that's what it's meant for. And the thought is that after a hurricane, you know, say if services are closed, you don't have power around, the traffic volume should be lower. So it's meant for after a storm.
Okay, that makes more sense.
Yeah.
Thank you.
Okay, let's move on to item. We got a busy day today, and we have, just make a quick comment, and we also were coming back at 1:30. I forgot to mention that for the CA. So, item F, general public comments and public comments on agenda items. Members of the public are invited to offer comments and or comments or questions on specific agenda items. Please complete and submit an online comment card available at palmbeachtpa.org/btpac_comments in advance of the meeting or during the meeting prior to the appropriate agenda item. All comments will be read into the record by TPA staff. General comments will be read prior to the first action item. Public comments on specific agenda items will be read following the presentation of the item to the committee. Public comments will also be permissible during the meeting. Note that the chair may limit comments to 3 minutes or less depending on meeting attendance. Staff, have any general comments been received?
No, Mr. Chair.
Item 2A, motion to recommend approval of FY19 and FY20 Unified Planning Work Program UPWP Amendment Number 3. Matthew Kama, TPA CFO, will present this item.
Morning, ladies and gentlemen. My name is Matthew Kama. I'm the CFO for the TPA. As mentioned, we come before you this morning with the first of two Unified Planning Work Program agenda items. The first item is an amendment to the current fiscal year 19 and fiscal year 20 UPWP. This agenda item is essentially three movements and then some realignment of funding. First, we are de-obligating $500,000 in FHWA PL funds from fiscal year 20 so that we can use them in fiscal year 21. Second, we are removing $600,000 of FHWA SU funding from the planning section and moving it to TPA priority projects in fiscal year 20. Third, we are adding $211,000 of FTA funding in fiscal year 20 to match currently available grant funding. And then we are, as mentioned, we're aligning our grants, our expenditures and funding for the fiscal year. That summarizes the amendment. Again, we're seeking recommendation of approval, and I'm available for any questions that you have.
Staff, are there any public comments on this item?
No, Mr. Chair.
Do any committee members have any comments or questions on the UPWP amendment? Again, please raise your hand function in the Zoom app and wait to be recognized before unmuting your microphone and or raise your hand if you don't have video or wave your hand if it's easier. Are there any comments? Mark, do you see anyone raising their hand, Margie?
Nope, we don't have any, Mr. Chair.
Okay.
And this one does require a roll call vote.
Okay. Well, I need a motion. Is there a motion to recommend adoption of the FY19, FY20 UPWP Amendment Number 3?
I'm going to unmute all.
Okay. I'll make that motion. This is Ted.
Ryan can second.
Okay. So I have a motion, and a second to recommend adoption of the FY19, FY20 UPWP Amendment Number 3. We're going to do a roll call on this one. Is that correct?
That's correct.
You're going to do the roll call, Margie? Is that Sally's person?
Yes. So Sally Channon, I just want to confirm neither her or Lee is in this meeting. Eric Ferguson?
Yes, aye.
Ted?
Aye.
Michael Howell?
Aye.
Yash?
Aye.
Fadi?
Aye.
Michael Owens.
Aye.
Craig.
Aye.
Ryan.
Aye.
Brian.
Aye.
Bob.
Aye.
Joanne.
Aye.
Garrett.
Aye.
That passes unanimously, Mr. Chair.
Okay. Motion passes unanimously. Item 2B, motion to recommend approval of the FY21-22 UPWP. And Matthew Kama will also present this item.
Excellent. Thank you. The second item is the 21-22 UPWP. And just as an overview of what this document does and why it's so critical to our agency. I think the slide's going to catch up to us in just a moment. But the UPWP is our two-year business plan and budget. It covers a time frame of July 1st of 2020 through June 30th of 2022. And it also constitutes our application for federal grant funding. Included in the UPWP is what we're going to accomplish. We show that with deliverables. Who will do that, whether it will be staff or consultants or both. When we plan to accomplish that with completion dates and targets, and how much it will cost to accomplish that work. And that's with budget and funding source information. For fiscal year 21 and 22, our available revenue funding is $4.5 million in 21 and $3.75 million in fiscal year 22. That breaks down roughly into 93% federal, 3.5% state, and 3.4% local funding to fund operations. To fund the agency, I'll clarify. And then fiscal year 21-22 expenditures, we divide these in two parts, grant-funded expenditures and locally funded expenditures. And then they're further broken down into four categories. So in grant-funded expenditures, we have personnel, travel, consultant, and direct expenses. And then our locally funded expenditures, that's our advocacy, public engagement, staff performance, and then the balance would go to a reserve fund for the agency. Our total expenditures, we keep those within the available revenue for the year, and they're $4.5 million in 21 and $3.75 in fiscal year 22. To follow the timeline for adoption of this document, today we bring before you the draft UPWP. On May 21st, it will go to the TPA board for adoption, and then it will be transmitted to FHWA and FTA for final approval by June 30th. That concludes my presentation. We are seeking a recommendation for approval, and I'm available for any questions that you have.
Staff, are there any public comments on this item?
No, Mr. Chair.
Do any committee members have any comments or questions on the FY21-22 UPWP? Go ahead.
No, I was going to say, I have that Ted and then Fadi have their hands raised.
Alrighty, okay. And anyone else, just remember to use the raise hand function and wait to be recognized. And you'll have to remember to unmute your microphone. So who was first, Margie?
Ted. And I've unmuted you, Ted.
Thank you. My question was on the travel amount. Since we're all learning that we can communicate virtually, should the travel amount in this budget be reduced?
The travel, I said it for brevity, but it's travel and a training, and we don't know the full impact of what this current pandemic will have, but we do know that continued training, and there will likely be some travel as it comes back. So we don't have enough information to adjust that yet, but we can refine that as things develop.
Thank you.
And Margie was
And then I had Fadi as okay. next.
Okay, Fadi.
Yeah, Ted had the same question I had.
Okay, and I don't see any other hands raised.
Okay, is there, does anyone want to make a motion to recommend approval?
Oh, sorry, I'm unmuting all so that they can make a motion. And I'm not sure who I'm getting feedback from, I'm sorry.
Motion to approve the amendment.
So I have a motion by Brian.
Second.
And a second by Michael Owens.
Okay, is there any discussion on the... Okay. So the question is the adoption, recommend approval of the FY 2022 UPWP. All those in favor, we're going to have to do
a roll. This one is a roll call too, yes. I see that Sally or Lee is still not present. Eric?
Aye.
Ted?
Aye.
Michael Howe?
Aye.
Yash?
Aye.
Fadi?
Aye.
Michael Owens?
Aye.
Craig?
Aye.
Ryan?
Aye.
Aye.
Oh, Ryan and Brian. Sorry, I should say last names for those two, but I heard aye from both of them. Bob?
Aye.
Joanne?
Aye.
Garrett?
Aye.
It passes unanimously, Mr. Chair.
Okay. We're on to informational items. This is the item A, the draft fiscal year 21-25. Transportation Improvements Program, TIP. And Jason Price, TPA TIP Coordinator, will present this item.
Hi, good morning, everyone. My name is Jason Price. Can you hear me okay? Can everybody hear me all right?
Yes, Jason, they're muted.
Okay. So good morning. I'm going to present the draft TIP to everyone this morning. The draft TIP. For new members, it's a programming document that covers a five-year time horizon from fiscal year 2021 to fiscal year 2025. It's a five-year time horizon. And what the TIP consists of is a list of projects that FDOT has programmed, as well as regional and local There's a little delay. So to begin, I'll go over the timeline of how the TIP is developed. So to begin, the TPA develops a priority list of projects in July 2019 as a result of the grant programs and the major TPA projects. We submit that list to FDOT, and they evaluate the funds that are available and assign funds to those projects when they develop a draft tentative work program. And that happens at around October in 2019. When they release a draft tentative work program to us, or just a draft work program, we utilize that to develop our draft TIP document and incorporate their projects, as well as the projects that they programmed from the previous priority list. And that's what's before you today. In the future, well, the near future and next month, this will be an action item and we'll approve the final TIP. And what's before you today is just a draft. So we'll go through some of the components of it in the next few slides, and then you'll see what's being programmed and what will be constructed in this next, in the next TIP. So once it's adopted in its final form in June, we'll start to operate under it in July. And that'll run through till next year on June 30th. So how the TIP is structured, it's structured into sections, and there's color-coded boxes here to show you what the subcategories are in each of the sections. The first section is TPA priority projects, and that's the TPA major projects, the major priority projects that we program, and then our two grant-funded programs, local initiatives and transportation alternatives. And then the other sections include the FDOT priority projects, which is their strategic intermodal system capacity projects, are called CISP capacity projects. That's their mainline projects that are, you know, the big ticket items for I-95 and the turnpike and you know, facilities such as that. There's also other projects, which are other FDOT projects, and then the local projects that we request from local agencies from their capital improvement programs and incorporate those projects as well. In addition, there's the other modes of transportation, including airports, railroads, and seaports. And lastly, there's the maintenance and operation. There's a few subcategories here, and they all pertain to either, you know, operating and maintaining the infrastructure that's that's constructed. And that includes roadways and transit. So when you scroll through, when you open up the TIP, you'll get the first tables you'll come across in the first few pages are summary tables of the three first categories of the major TPA projects, the transportation alternative projects, and the local initiative projects. So in these summary tables, this is just a diagram that shows you how to read the tables. So the two grant programs and the major TPA projects all have a rank assigned to them in the year that they are programmed. And so that's the first thing that you see on the left. And then moving from left to right, it just detailed information in terms of the project location, the description, and then the five fiscal years to show you the breakdown of how the project is being constructed through, you know, the design phase through construction. And then what the funding is still needed, and then any notes regarding the project. So these tables are, you know, available for both, you know, for the local initiatives, transportation alternatives, and major TPA major projects. Now I'll go into a little more detail about the major TPA projects, followed by local initiatives and transportation alternatives. So first off, the major TPA projects has a five-year target of about $114 million in federal and state funds. And this year, there's about $156 million programmed in this particular TIP. And some of the highlights kind of allude to that number in terms of the State Route 7, the two State Route 7 projects in the highlights. That cost is incorporated into the major TPA projects, and so that's why it's a little more than $114 million due to the cost of those projects. But they are reprogrammed in this year's TIP. Also, there's two other projects here that you can see that were delayed. The design was delayed in the Tri-Rail Extension project to Jupiter, as well as the construction of the Atlantic Avenue from State Route 7 to Lyons Road. So moving on to the local initiatives. That has a five-year target of $100 million in federal and state funds, and both the local initiatives and transportation alternatives programs have been operating fairly well and maximizing the funding that's allocated to those programs. And from the highlights, there's just two here. The programs have been really successful, and so all six new projects were funded for construction for fiscal year 24 and 25 from the last grant cycle that we had. So that's a good sign that, you know, everything has been funded through the years through the TIP. And as a result of previous grant cycles and from the inception of the project, there's eight projects scheduled for construction in fiscal year 21. So that's kind of the fruits of the labor of the program and of, you know, applying for the grants and watching it move through the TIP and, you know, getting to the goal line of constructing the project. So there's eight new projects being constructed. So That's a really positive sign of the program being productive and producing good projects. So for transportation alternatives, it's the similar case of, you know, a well-producing program of projects, and that has a three-year target of $9 million in federal and state funds. And this program, too, all four projects that were applied for last year are funded for construction through fiscal year 23. And then also there's six projects that are scheduled for construction in the near future in fiscal year 22 from as a result of the previous grant cycles. And then I just listed a couple of other highlights for Belvedere Heights neighborhood sidewalk and lighting, and also the FPNO pathway lighting from Lamstein Lane to Las Palmas Street. Both of those have future construction years. So all good positive signs for the program. And then there's other construction that'll happen in this next year in 2021. So I listed some of the construction highlights. The presentation will be available. I won't read through all of these, but you can see that there's some road resurfacing projects. There's roadway capacity projects for widening lane segments throughout the county. And also there's some bridge projects, the Jupiter Inlet Bridge replacement from US 1 to A1A to Beach Road, and the Palm Beach Lakes Boulevard Bridge rehab over the FEC corridor. There's also several intersection improvement projects that are also listed in the TIP. That's all. That concludes my presentation. I'm available for any questions.
Do any committee members have any comments or questions on the draft TIP? Again, please use the raise hand function in the Zoom app and wait to be recognized before unmuting your microphone.
And Chair, just to confirm, we did not receive any public comments on this item.
Sorry, I forgot.
No, no worries. I'm here to remind you.
Yeah. Any raise hands, Margie?
I don't see any. Oh, Ted and Body. I'm sorry. Okay, Ted. It doesn't seem to be letting me unmute you. Hold on. Ted, I'm not sure if you have locked it on your side, but for some reason I'm not able to unmute you. Are you able to unmute on your phone? Or, I'm sorry, on your screen reader? And if you want, while we're sorting through that, if Fadi, you wanted to make your comments.
Could you hear me?
Yes.
Yes.
Well, first of all, I don't know how to raise my hand on the application. I didn't see any kind of icon or something to do it. So I'm just raising my hand on the video. Yeah, I just wanted to make a comment. I think it's the same that Mo did at the TPA meeting. This regarding the DOT project on B line, which is to give priority to trucks. We just have some concerns about that because, you know, it's crossing major intersections that are really congested. And by giving more time to, you know, to other to less congested directions, you're going to affect, you know, the main congestion. So I just wanted to make this point, but that's all.
And Ted, it looks like you were able to unmute.
I think I did.
Thank you so much.
You're very welcome. I don't know how I muted, but I guess this is just a comment. If next month we're going to look at this for a vote, then it would be – you had some tables and you had some things that you briefly discussed. For me personally – I need more detail, and I know that I've mentioned that before, and other people have said, yeah, I can't see the screen. and that was when we were actually in person, but just be more detailed about what's in your document. And tables in PowerPoint are not screen reader friendly.
Do you have any recommendation how to provide it? Like, is there any preferred method?
Well, you can, instead of putting a table, you can divide the sections on the slide into different,
Different slides like in, this.
Yeah, either different slides or different sections on the slide. So you have your title and then you can make three or four different, sections for the information. And that way a screen reader can read it. But if you put in a table, it doesn't work.
Okay. Thank you. That's good to know.
And then Eric, I had your hand was raised, followed by Brian, followed by Bob.
Okay, you can do the other members.
Okay, so Brian, if you wanted to, go ahead.
I was wondering if the Tri-Rail PD&E study, if we have any more details on why the funding was pushed back a year for that.
I don't recall. I think it was delayed last year, too.
Yeah,
I don't know exactly.
It continues to be delayed because there is no funding for identified for operations and maintenance. Mm-hmm. So it's kind of a desire that we want to have this happen, but until there's an actual plan to fund it besides the capital, it's just kind of there. And we also need a FEC easement for it. So that's the other piece that's needed to be able to move forward since it's on someone else's right of way and the FEC hasn't been open or interested in talking about that. I think they're more focused on extending Brightline phase two than engaging in a conversation about allowing another user on their right of way for now.
Thank you.
Thank you, Valerie.
And I have Bob is next, and then you, Eric.
Okay, Bob.
Actually, I answered my own question, but I realized that the information that was attached to the to the minutes or the agenda that there's tables for each of these, which all the detail on it. And I think what Ted was saying is that he has a hard time with tables. So I think that's the other part of it. But I guess bottom line, I don't need any more I don't have any more to talk about.
Okay, Margie, any other raised hands or is
Nope, it's just you.
Okay. I'm going to expand on Brian's question about the Tri-Rail extension. I think that it seems to get pushed every year. And there's a comment. Maybe we ought to start thinking about, is it possible for Brightline to have a local service? Because this has been planned for so long to do it with Tri-Rail, but things have changed. Maybe we need to think out of the box and maybe it's not, even if we can't do a full PD&E, is there a way we could allocate some staff or consultant resources to look at some kind of what would be feasible, like a public-private partnership with, Brightline? Is there something else? Is there some other alternative to a full-blown PD&E that would let us look at other options, kind of work with all the stakeholders along the corridor? Because it's just every year it's the same thing it's a chicken.
Yeah, and the full study and market analysis was done in, I think, 2014. And all, prioritizing the stations, looking at how the service would run, where it would make the most sense. Unfortunately, we don't have, obviously, control of Brightline. It's or FEC. They're a private entity. But the cities have, like Boca Raton, have been approaching and talking with Brightline individually, they want to be a limited stop service, but it's a public-private partnership type situation between the cities and Brightline, just as the situation is with Boca Raton, which is moving forward with a station in their location, which was originally proposed to be a Tri-Rail Coastal Link station, but now it's going to be a Brightline station there. So we think we've suggested also for Palm Beach Gardens, who's been really taking steps forward to have a station in their location and has done additional studies, that would also be a good opportunity to hopefully work out with Brightline, maybe a station there, since that seems to be more of a feasible short-term option than relying on Tri-Rail Coastal Link that doesn't have funding or property to build it yet.
Okay, yeah, my comment is just that there are ways we could allocate resources to kind of investigate the feasibility of some sort of partnership where, I don't know, there's a lot of ways to do it. And you look at the Transcontinental Railroad was probably across the U.S. was a public-private partnership with the federal government. So we have a long history of kind of building rail infrastructure projects that way. And my second was, I'm just wondering the transportation alternatives in general, it's, you know, was it $3 million a year approximately?
3.1.
Why can't that, what would it take for that? I think those are such great projects that I'm just wondering why it's such a small percentage of the TIP and how could that be increased?
Yeah.
This is Andrew. With the TPA, I can answer that for you. So those are funds we get from the federal government, and we get half those funds, about 1.6 or so, comes directly to us, and about 1.6 goes to our district, and they get those to us to prioritize as well. So that 3.1 is really based on just federal legislation for transportation alternatives. So that's sort of what we're going off of for that. However, they are great projects. And what we have seen is a lot of the same types of projects that you see under transportation alternatives, you also see under local initiatives, which has that $5 million cap per project. And we do see a lot of non-motorized products and safety products in there. And actually, all the things that are really eligible under TA can also be eligible under local initiatives based on federal legislation. So they're under the Surface Transportation Block Grant legislation, and the transportation alternatives is really just a set aside of that. So there is opportunities to fund more of these types of projects through local initiatives. Obviously, the scoring is a little bit different because that's a broader scoring criteria that incorporates other things such as vehicle mobility and other infrastructure-related scoring, but there is that opportunity. So if it was going to come down to directly funding transportation alternatives more, that would be a push that we would have towards federal legislation.
Okay. But one, just follow up and I'll move on because we got a lot of stuff to cover. You said the TA versus the LI. Don't some of them can only be along a federal aid eligible road? For example, like a paved trail that connects, that's not along a roadway would not be eligible for one of the two funding mechanisms. I'm trying to seem to mix them up, which one you can do what with.
Sure. That's a good point. Correct. So local initiative, the Surface Transportation Block Grant Program, is supposed to be for federal aid eligible roadways, which are those which are urban collectors or higher. And then transportation alternatives can be used off of federal aid eligible roadways. There is legislation in there that our interpretation of it is that you can use your local initiatives funds for transportation alternatives types of projects off the federal aid system. So like that's one of the exceptions in the law. It hasn't really been tested much here in our county. I think we have Germantown Road that is one that is off the federal aid system, that is in local initiatives, and that hasn't gotten to the point where it's been reimbursed yet, but we're expecting that one to be reimbursed. So it is possible if the product is mostly transportation alternatives in nature with pedestrian and bicycle facilities that it could potentially be off the federal aid system.
Interesting. Yeah, I'd like you guys to keep an eye on that because there's some projects I'm thinking of because that would kind of help move some of the LIs to the TA list. So. Garrett has his, Margie, is Garrett raised his hand? Is that correct?
Yes, he's raised his hand.
Okay. Here's next, Garrett.
Just a quick question on that BRT light. There we go. Sorry. That BRT light for Camino Real, I noticed there wasn't any funding or cost or anything associated with it. Was there a reason it was on the list?
Let's see. Which program is it under?
It's on the first page. Hold on, let me scroll to it.
The Lake Worth? No.
It's on the first table.
Okay, the major projects.
Yes. Sorry, my computer just snapped. Yeah. I lost it, but there we go. I'm getting there. So the project number is 4383861. US 1 Camino Real to Indian Town Road.
Yeah.
BRT light.
Yeah.
This is our, we did a US 1 multimodal corridor study for this entire corridor where we identified roadway improvements and roadway modifications and as well as enhanced transit service as such as BRT light. And we proposed that to, it's a major TPA priority project, but we proposed that to FDOT to evaluate. So they have to do a feasibility study and then that's being broken out into separate pieces. So it continues to be a TPA priority project, but they have to look at it closer to see what those costs are. But we have it there as this is important to us. We want to move it forward.
Got it. So DOT comes back and says, okay, this is feasible. We want to do it. Then we'll allocate money towards it.
Yeah. They'll confirm the cost and how much and so forth. So there's one section, for example, that's moving forward, currently from 59th Street to North Lake Boulevard, and they've put in costs to do the feasibility study to actually see if what we proposed in our study is actually feasible and then fine tune it further for actual design and construction later. But right now they're just moving forward with feasibility of that section.
Great. Thank you.
Sorry, Valerie.
I just wanted to piggyback on Andrew's response earlier just to note that the local initiative funds are federal funds. And so that should be spent more on regional connectivity facilities. So usually they're longer facilities that benefit more people versus TA, which is a smaller pot is more of those shorter pedestrian bicycle facility connectivity projects. But just wanted to note that as well.
Okay. I think I saw Fatty raise his hand. Is that?
Yes, that's what I was going to tell you.
Okay. Fatty.
Yes. I think I just wanted to make kind of an observation. It seems like the COVID-19 impact on transportation is really kind of to promote walking, biking, maybe electrical bike and scooters, and disfavor maybe transit and BRT and so forth. It would be nice, I mean, to have at least some budget to evaluate the impact as we move forward, because I think some of this impact may stay with us after this epidemic is over. Be nice for us at least to have an idea what the impact was on these modes of transportation so we can better plan for the future.
All right, Margie, anyone else? Or we're going to move on.
I didn't see anybody else, and I don't see any other hands raised.
Okay. Item 3B, Florida Transportation Plan Update. Jessica Jocelyn, FDOT consultant, will present this item.
Yes, thank you, Chairman. Can everyone hear me okay?
Yes.
Okay, and I'm going to share my screen. Can everyone see my screen or a thumbs up? Okay, great. Well, good morning, everyone. I'm excited to present to you today on behalf of Larry Wallace with the Florida Department of Transportation, District 4. So thank you for the opportunity to present the Florida Transportation Plan. I want to just, before diving into the presentation, walk through the goals that I have today in presenting this. They are threefold. The first is to inform you about the purpose of the Florida Transportation Plan and why it matters. I know several of you are probably familiar with this plan since it's been going on for quite some time now, but just in case there are new folks, I wanted to give background, and then also just a refresher because I know you all are working on a lot of different projects. The second thing is I want to highlight some key trends impacting transportation that the state is finding across different cross-cutting topics. And then most importantly, I'm here today to gather your input and seek your feedback, especially being a bicycle, pedestrian, and trails group. It's very important that we reach your expertise and passion and bring that feedback into the transportation plan update. I also wanted to give you a heads up that there is an interactive survey in the presentation today. It's just going to require you to pull up your cell phone. And it's pretty straightforward, so hopefully that'll be easy for everyone moving into the presentation. But in about 8 to 10 minutes, if you could have your cell phone ready for the interactive survey, that would be appreciated. So now diving in further into the presentation. So the Florida Transportation Plan is the single overarching statewide plan guiding Florida's transportation future. It is a plan for all of Florida, not just Southeast Florida, created by and providing direction to the Florida Department of Transportation and all organizations that are involved in planning and managing Florida's transportation system. The plan provides policy guidance and also establishes the policy framework for allocating the state and federal transportation funds, which flow through the Florida Department of Transportation's five-year work program. So definitely relevant to some of the discussion in past items on today's agenda. It is important because it not only sets a long-range vision for the future, but also guides transportation decision-making today. The plan considers several things that I'm just gonna walk through right now to make sure you're aware of these different elements. So the first is to attain our goal of zero fatalities on Florida's transportation system. So kudos, I think it was Boynton Beach for approving the Vision Zero policy. To provide a more efficient and mobile transportation system, meet the needs of growing and changing populations, make our economy more competitive, enhance the quality of life and environment of Florida's communities, to increase opportunities for access to transit and other modes of transportation, also discussed during today's agenda, and then address emerging issues such as the rapid changes in technologies. So quite a few things that this plan is trying to look into and address. We'd like to give an example of how the Florida Transportation Plan really is impactful. And one example is back when we did the 2020 Florida Transportation Plan that actually led to the creation of the Strategic Intermodal System, which we refer to as the SIS in this group commonly. And as you know, funding did go to the SIS ultimately. So that is a strong example of how this plan really can impact how we plan for our transportation future. The Department of Transportation prepares numerous statewide plans, which are guided by and help inform the Florida Transportation Plan. Again, I'm sure many of you are familiar with these other plans. They include modal plans, the Freight Mobility and Trade Plan, and then, as I was mentioning, the SIS. It also includes the SIS Policy Plan. So during the Florida Transportation Update process, the department will draw upon these various visions and plans. And also we're drawing upon partners' plans, such as your long-range transportation plan, in terms of getting input into the development of this update. So now moving forward, I'm gonna talk about the goals and objectives of the plan that we're looking at right now. Excuse me. Before diving into the goals, though, I do want to mention there are three elements of the Florida Transportation Plan. The first element is a vision element, which looks about 50 years out, so it's more of your long-term assessment. The second element, which is really the heart of the plan, has a 25-year horizon, very similar to your long-range transportation plan. And then the third element is an implementation element, which looks at short and midterm horizons and trying to best align strategies to actions for implementation that align with the goals and objectives. I do want to note in this update, the department is considering a fourth element that focuses on performance measurement and also bringing in the federal requirements related to performance measurement. So more to come on that. The goals that you see here on the slide, they are remaining largely intact from the last update, if you remember that plan. However, refinements were made to them, such as linking transportation choices to improvements in accessibility and equity. And those changes actually reflect input from the partners and public in the last round of outreach. The goal areas you'll see here are representative of themes that have been historically highlighted in plans and consider emerging trends and technologies that are impacting the transportation system. The objectives identified for these goals often overlap across multiple goal areas. This update of the plan will consider objectives and strategies also within four cross-cutting topics to better align the objectives and strategies and to provide clear direction for implementation. Those four cross-cutting topics are technology, resilience, state and interregional transportation, and regional and local needs. So looking a bit further at those four cross-cutting topics, here on this slide are some details regarding them. I won't read them off, but I do want to highlight right now the resilience category, or cross-cutting topic rather, especially during this COVID-19 situation. I think we're all looking at resilience, you know, beyond just the environmental impact, and that certainly is the case for the Florida Transportation Plan update. So in addition to considering environmental impacts, the plan is also going to consider economic and societal changes and how we can look at resilience from that standpoint as well. So here's a slide just showing some stats and infographics for emerging trends across those four cross-cutting topics that I just walked through. If you're interested in learning more behind these trends and the data analysis that was conducted, we do have that information on our website at www.floridatransportationplan.com. For the sake of keeping this within time, I won't be walking through those details, but they are available should you want them. So now, as I was mentioning in my introduction, we're going to try the Poll Everywhere interactive survey. For those of you, I'm assuming everyone has a smartphone. If you don't have a smartphone, please raise your hand and we can walk through the other options. But the website that you're gonna pull up on your smartphone is www.pollev.com/F=Florida, T as in transportation, P as in plan, 2045. Also, if you have a QR code scanner on your cell phone, that should work if you hold it up to the slide with the QR code there. There is also the option to text. It's a little more clunky, but it certainly is still an option if you prefer texting. The number that you're going to put in the text is 22333, and you're going to text F as in Florida, T as in transportation, P as in plan, 2045. So hopefully everyone can read the slide here and plug it into your phone. When you get to the site, it's going to ask for you to type in your name, and then it'll keep you waiting on a homepage, waiting for me, the host, to activate the survey. I also wanted to highlight that Kurt Lehman from Cambridge Systematics, who helps really make this all possible with the Poll Everywhere, working with Central Office. He is on the virtual meeting today and will be taking notes and snapshots of the live polling so that we have the ability to turn around quite quickly the responses should you want to look back at them following this meeting. So, Chairman, do you think I've given enough time? I'm not sure if you can see all the, maybe a few more seconds. Just want to make sure everyone's logged in. And again, it's www.pollev.com/FTP2045. Okay. Chairman, are you logged on? You can be maybe my, yeah? Okay, excellent. So I'm gonna go ahead and start. If you are behind, the address will be on the slides as we start this. So, and I didn't mention there are three multiple choice questions and then two open-ended. So just wanted to kind of give that background up front. So the first question is, what trend is the most important to or will have the biggest impact on the Florida, on Florida's transportation future? We have several options here. The options were crafted based on past feedback and input. But certainly if you have a, you know, an urge to share something else, I'm happy to take that comment. But there are open-ended questions at the end as well for you to have the opportunity to add something new. I'll give everyone just a little bit of time to digest the options, put in your response. Okay. So it's looking like new ways to travel will be the most important or have the biggest impact on our future. The next question, in your opinion, what is the greatest challenge for Florida to overcome related to changing technology in our transportation system? So the integrating technology into our existing system has definitely been a theme as the greatest challenge across the different groups we speak with. So I think that'll end up being definitely a focus area, I would suspect. Okay, moving to the next. So this is the last multiple choice question. What is the top trend or disruptor affecting Florida's transportation system? And I know some of these options do, you know, interrelate with one another or influence one another, but if you can just, you know, subjectively choose the one that kind of resonates most with you, that would be great. Hey, it looks like poor or inoperable infrastructure is the top trend or disruptor from your group for this question. Okay, so now we're getting into the two open-ended questions. So we'll give a little bit more time for you to think about it and then also to type it in. I know it's sometimes tricky on the cell phone to type a lot. But what regional or local needs should be considered as we update the Florida transportation plan? And kind of sky's the limit here. Anything you can think of that comes to mind, please make sure to comment. I'll give about 15 more seconds or so as you guys are typing. Great. I'm really appreciating the focus, of course, on ped bike and trails. Okay, well, I'm going to move on to the next and last open-ended question. How can we best implement the Florida Transportation Plan strategies across Florida's varied regions and localities to ensure maximum success in achieving the goals I previously mentioned of the Florida Transportation Plan? And again, kind of sky's the limit here. It can be about funding. It can be about coordination and collaboration, decision-making processes. It could be technical related data collection, you know, really anything you can think of. I'll give folks just a little bit more time, and there's just one slide left, and then I'll be wrapping up, Chairman. And I will say on this question, kind of some common themes that I've been seeing to date have been focusing on creating flexibility in funding, so that the different types of areas and makeup throughout the state can use funding as in alignment with their needs that may differ. And also a big focus on more local input. So I am seeing definitely some commonalities with your responses as well. Okay. Well, hopefully that worked easily for everyone. I do want to say on behalf of the department, we really value your input and appreciate the time you're spending with us today to walk through this important plan update. Just in closing, I want to walk through some of the logistics so you know moving forward what's going to happen. So I did note the input received today will be provided back to you just so you can confirm and see that everything was gathered. But all input received for meetings like this that we're doing throughout the state is organized by the project team, including Kurt on the line, and presented to the diverse 30-plus member steering committee guiding the plan update. More information, as I mentioned earlier, is on the Florida Transportation Plan website. Again, including those cross-cutting topics, if you're interested, the website is at the top left corner of the slide, again, floridatransportationplan.com, and the slides will be posted on the TPA website if you need a reminder there. There are multiple ways to get involved. Of course, you got involved today through this presentation, but there are also online surveys and general feedback forms on the website should you wish to go that route. And then I also want to just mention the schedule. Similar to probably many of your projects and the TPA's projects, schedules are being impacted from COVID-19, and we're in a bit of an unknown situation with how that progresses. So one immediate impact that we have concluded is that the regional workshops, where they typically bring people together in person to provide input, those have been put on pause due to social distancing requirements. However, we are successful in doing these virtual engagements, so we're hopeful that we'll still have quite a bit of input. And the draft plan, we will still be publishing and providing a 30-day comment period, so we'll make sure to keep this group up to date on when the draft plan is available for your review and commenting. And then last, we are still anticipating to try to conclude the plan on December of this year. So in closing, of course, Larry's on the line here and I'm here, but Lois Bush is leading this effort for District 4, coordinating very closely with Central Office. So although she's not presenting, she wanted me to make sure that you knew that she's happy to take any comments or feedback from you all. Her phone number and email address is here if you don't already have it. And again, it'll be posted on your website when this presentation gets uploaded. So with that, Chairman, I'm happy to take any questions now.
Okay, we have to see if there's public comments. Staff, are there any public comments on this item?
No public comments have been received.
Okay. Do any committee members have any comments or questions on the FTP?
I do have that Yash has his hand raised.
Okay. And Margie, I'm going to step out for about maybe a minute or two. Do we have a co-chair or?
Yes. So I believe it's Brian is your vice chair.
Vice chair. Okay. I'll be back in about two
is
minutes.
Is that right? Hold on. Stephanie. So, and if you do need to step away because Stephanie is not present, you would need to do a vice chair pro tem, essentially.
Okay. Well, I can wait. Let's finish this item and then we'll maybe recess for 5 minutes, maybe 2 minutes after.
Okay.
Let's do the staff questions. member questions.
Who's okay. First? So I have Yash and then I have Larry.
Okay, Yash.
Hey, can you hear me?
Yes.
So just a quick comment. The live polling was a great idea. I'm definitely going to steal that at some point. And a great presentation. Thank you.
Thank you. I appreciate that. Yeah, and if you need any tips or tricks on the polling, please feel free to reach out and I'll connect you. I can't take credit for any of that. I'm not that technologically savvy.
Appreciate it. Thank you.
And then I have Larry has his hand up.
Yeah, I just wanted to say excellent job presenting on my behalf. Jessica, great job. Thank you so much. Hope everybody enjoyed the presentation.
Okay, anyone else?
Yeah, I'm really looking forward. I just wanted to say I'm really looking forward to bringing back, if it's not me, the department, all the collective input and the impact it has on this round of the Florida Transportation Plan. Exciting times.
Anyone? Brian has his hand up. Next up, is that right, Margie?
Yes, Brian.
Okay, Brian.
Hey, Jessica, Larry, thanks for the presentation. I was wondering, do you have any detail, or maybe it hasn't hit this part yet, I might have missed it in what you just said about input with regards to members of the public. I know strategies are definitely shifting right now, but have you gone to public at all with any of this information, or is there a way that the TPA could, I've seen it, I believe, shared from the TPA's emails before, but is there anything else that we could do as far as municipalities to try to get the word out about this?
Yeah, that's a great question. So Larry, I'll take this question, and then if you have anything to add, please jump in.
Okay.
Lois is just doing a phenomenal job and taking to heart really the need to get out there and promote this and get input. I will say COVID-19 kind of came right in the beginning as we were planning the outreach. So we're putting together a plan right now to get to the public. So I would love to put into that plan any outreach with the cities, if that's something it looks like you're willing to sign up for. I think this is great timing to offer that, because, like I said, we're just in the stages of going beyond kind of the MPO type meetings and get a larger kind of web and netcast to different folks. So are there any particular things you're thinking of with your city that maybe others on the call could benefit from hearing about that I can share with Lois?
I would think that a lot of municipalities have a public information officer that if you provide them with really easily utilizable content to share across social media platforms, so Instagram, Facebook, et cetera, if you create those, you know, materials for members on the boards, it will likely be a little bit easier for us to try to craft a message and get it out there for you. Kind of like what the Census 2020 campaign has done. They've done a great job at just giving materials to municipalities to share rather than, you know, relying on the municipalities and to get the information out and to create the content. That is what's going to bog you down in trying to work with municipalities to get the word out. That would be my recommendation.
Okay.
Would take that to Lois.
Great. Yeah, and actually, there is a social media campaign already prepared, but because of the direction, the state having such an important role with messaging during COVID-19, that's, you know, taken over, and they don't want to dilute that or send impressions that, you know, it's not as important.
Yep.
Yeah, so we're ready to roll with that as soon as, you know, hopefully everyone stays healthy and well, and we can move forward hopefully into better times. But I took note of what you said, and I'll make sure to share that. Larry, did you have anything different to add, or
no, not at all?
I said?
We have a I think Melissa is on the call too. Melissa, we can share some information together, as well as we have a public information officer, Billy. I forget his last name, but Lois and I can share the information with Billy. And then he can go ahead and share that on FDOT's social media page. But thanks, Brian, for bringing that to our attention. Appreciate it.
Yeah, and Melissa's been, we have been promoting it in our social media and in the past few newsletters as well. So I can check with her to see if we have kind of a package already of social media content and graphics prepared by FDOT. If not, Jess, if you guys want to send us something, we can share with BTPAC everyone, or for those who are interested. But
great. I'm excited. Thank you for those kind of raising their hand to help spread the word.
Agreed. Thank you.
Bonnie, you had your hand up? Yeah.
Yeah, I think it's the same comment. I mean, I don't know how often FDP is updated. I know it's a long-term document, and I know you're planning, as you mentioned, to kind of finish the report by December, but I believe there's fundamental changes going on right now, and it may take some time as far as, you know, peak hour mobility, freight mobility, you know, people working, different way of working, telecommuting. I don't think, you know, finishing it by December is more important than really understanding what's going on and projecting for the future. So just my comment, I think, is to really keep this input going on for a while until we better understand what the impact would be, so we'd have a more meaningful document. Thank you.
Thank you, Fadi. Good comment. I wrote that down, and we'll make sure we get that in the notes as well to Lois and team.
Okay, Margie, anyone else?
I don't see any other hands raised virtually or physically.
So okay, we're going to take a two-minute
break. Oh, I'm sorry, Ted.
Looks like Ted.
I've sorry about that. No, I was okay. Trying to put my hand up virtually, but I believe you said you had a panel of 30 or 32 people that are looking at all of this. How many on that panel are persons with disabilities?
I don't know off the top of my head. Let me see if it's in the notes. Larry, do you know?
I do not, Ted. That's an excellent question. Can find out from Lois and get back with you in the
I am a person with a disability. I'm blind, and I appreciate the descriptiveness of the slides that you did, but it doesn't make it accessible for all. And if we're looking at transportation for all, then we need to be we have a saying in Boynton Beach, nothing about us without us. And it's really about making sure that everything is inclusive that we do going forward. It's been almost, well, it'll be 30 years on the 26th when the United States finally decided that, oh, wait, we need to include people with disabilities. And although we've come a long way, we haven't come far enough to including all.
Agree. Thank you for that comment. I appreciate the perspective should it have been missed in any way. And we will get back to you, Larry, and I will look into that to make sure all are accounted for on the steering committee. And also the groups we're reaching out to as well. I think it's important.
Yeah. And that's why I ended up on this committee. They asked me, well, I was recommended and then applied, and I'm on because I'm representing the population of disabled persons for the county. And, you know, they've been, everyone has been extremely receptive to the feedback, and I just want to keep it going.
Great. Well, I'm grateful to have you here today with us. Appreciate it.
Thank you.
Thanks, Ted, for the comment.
You're welcome.
Okay, Margie, anyone else?
I don't think so. I think
don't have a vice chair. I said we'll recess for maybe 2 minutes. I'll be right back. I apologize. But by the time we elect someone else, it'll take as long. So, sorry.
Biological break. Thank you, everyone.
Break.
Eric, I do have everybody muted for the most part, and it looks like quite a few people did take a break, so we may need just a few more minutes. And I think I muted you, so.
Yeah, I see a lot of other people took advantage of the
break. So maybe longer than 2 minutes.
Yeah, we're at 10:40. C, D.
And then your next presentation for the Florida Design Manual. We do have Chris McCurdy on the line, and she's ready to share her screen once you're ready to get back
into
the meeting.
And is there also, I saw Chris or Scott Peterson's also on?
Yes. So Chris and Scott will present this item. But once everybody's back, we'll go ahead and you can introduce the items. I do have that Michael Owens raised his hand.
Can you hear me?
Yes, we can.
Okay, great. Thank you. I've got an 11 o'clock that I've kind of back-to-back with this one. So unless they do a last-minute postponement, I'll probably just duck out right at 11 and get into that meeting. I just wanted to let you know.
Okay. It, the nice thing with Zoom is that it does tell me when members join and leave the meeting, so I'll have the exact time when you leave the meeting, and okay. I'll note it for the record.
We discussed earlier, Margie, I won't be able to attend the other one, so I can get excused absence for the 1:30 meeting. I've got 2 meetings in the afternoon as well.
Yes, so we will mark you as excused for the afternoon meeting.
Okay. Thank you very much.
You're welcome.
I didn't see Fatty come. The other people video, I didn't see Fatty back yet.
Yes, I think Joanne was another one on video.
Yeah, we'll give a couple more minutes.
Yes.
Okay, I think everyone's back, Margie?
Everyone that was sharing their screen looks to be back. And then I'm not sure about those that are appearing by phone. But if you want to go ahead and get started since the majority is back.
Yeah, I'm going to get started. We're at 10:40. So, okay. And everyone knows we have a 1:30 meeting. So I want to let everyone be able to eat lunch today. But this is an item I asked for a while back. I'm very excited about this this item. So it's Florida Design Manual Updates. FDOT staff is going to present the 2020 changes to the Florida Design Manual, specific to the bike. I'm going to abbreviate it, the bike chapter, the Design Manual. So it's something very, very relevant for this committee. And we have Chris McCurdy, FDOT Roadway Engineer, and Scott Peterson, FDOT District Roadway Design Engineer. To present this, and I'm just wondering, are you guys, what office are you out of too when you start? Be interested.
I'm at District 4 headquarters.
Okay.
Yes, yeah, same as me. Chris and I both work together in District 4 district office.
All right, let's start going, guys.
I can share my screen.
Yes, go ahead, Chris.
Okay, so I'm here to present to you about the updates to the 2020 FDM specific to 223 bicycle facilities and 224 shared use paths. Okay, the Florida Design Manual, also known as the FDM, states that FDOT shall provide bicycle facilities on all roadways on the state highway system, except where establishment would be contrary to public safety. So we have several ways to accommodate bicycles. We have bicycle lanes, which are on curbed roadways, marked shoulders, which are on flush shoulder roadways, and expanded this year in the FDM. Separated bicycle facilities began in the FDM in 2018, and they've expanded the section this year in 2020. Also new this year, shared use paths. You could not substitute a shared use path for a bicycle facility in previous editions of the FDM, so that's new this year. This is a graphic from FHWA in its preferred bikeway type for urban, suburban, and rural town contexts. And on the bottom is speed, and on the left side is volume in vehicles per day. And this is showing that at low speeds, low volumes, a shared lane with a bike works. But as speed increases and volume increases, you go to a buffered bike lane, and then preference for a separated bike lane. So the majority of users would prefer to be on a separated bike lane as traffic increases and speed increases. This is from the Bikeway Selection Guide, which is in 2019. And bicycle lanes can be on the road with a speed limit of 45 miles an hour or less, but best practice to consider other options at speeds greater than 30 miles per hour. Okay, the big changes in the FDM. We have more preferences towards shared use paths or physically separated bike lanes, and less preference toward adjacent on-street bike lanes. So for speeds greater than 30 miles an hour, there's more preference to accommodate bikes through shared use paths or physically separated bike lanes, with less preference for on-street bike lanes. I'm going to show you some photos, and these are all of on-street or bicycle facilities. The top photo is a buffered bike lane. The top right photo is a keyhole bike lane. So that is a bike lane between a through travel lane and, in this case, a right turn lane. So the buffered bike lane means it has the 2 6-inch white stripes. And then the keyhole means that you've got a travel lane and then you have something else such as a bus bay or a right turn lane adjacent to it. And the bottom photo is of a sharrow, which is a shared use. It's identifying that the bicyclist and the road or the vehicle, the motorist, can share the lane. Okay. So bike lanes are one-way facilities that carry bicycle traffic in the same direction as motor vehicle traffic. Okay. And bicycle lanes are on the curved roadway designed for the exclusive use of bicyclists. If it is on a flush shoulder roadway, it's called a mark shoulder. So we put bike lanes on roadways that are speeds 45 miles an hour and less. Okay. All right. So what's required for a bike lane? 7-foot buffered is preferred. And again, the buffered has the 2-foot striping, but you can have marked bike lanes as low as 4 feet. So you can have a 6-foot buffered bike lane, a 7-foot buffered bike lane, or you can mark a bike lane with 4 feet or 5 feet. If you have a 10-foot travel lane, you cannot mark a bike lane, a 4-foot bike lane next to a 10-foot travel lane. And if you have a keyhole location, which again is if you have a travel lane and a turn lane and the bike lane is in the middle, would be the keyhole. Okay, a lot of people don't really know what the green pavement markings are for, but what they are is they're to identify conflict areas between the bicycle facility and the motorist. So the graphic on the left shows a developing right turn lane. You have the green pavement marking starting 50 feet prior to the development of the right turn lane, and the solid green pavement markings extend 50 feet beyond where the traffic should have already gotten into the turn lane. The bottom graphic shows a channelized right turn lane, and again, you're having a conflict between the motorized vehicle and the bicycle, and so you're trying to draw attention by identifying the pavement with the green pavement markings. You also have to use the regular bicycle lane markings, the helmeted bicyclist and the arrow, in addition to the green pavement markings. And the photo on the right, it's hard to see on my screen because I see all the videos, but that's a bus bay on the very right. And then you have the conflict area because the bus is going to be crossing the bicycle facility. So you're calling attention so that both the bicyclist and the bus are going to know that there's a possible conflict there. All right, marked shoulders. So marked shoulders are paved shoulders that contains bike lane pavement markings, which again, you have to have the helmeted bike lane symbol and the arrow. You cannot have bicycle route signs for a marked shoulder. And when can you mark a shoulder? So the design speed has to be 45 miles an hour or less. You have to have at least 5 feet of pavement in the shoulder. And you would do it for C4, C5, or C6 context classifications, or C3 if demand is demonstrated. And if you had a shared use path next to a flush shoulder roadway, you would not mark the shoulder. the bikes would be accommodated on the shared use path. Okay, these are graphics. These are pictures of separated bike lanes, and you can separate so that the top one would be a median separation. So there's a distinct separation between the motor vehicle traffic and the bicyclists. On the upper right is a barrier wall. So you have barrier separating the bike lane from the motorized vehicle traffic. The bottom one is you're using parking. So you've got the travel lane, and to the left of that you have parallel parking. Then you have a separator, and then you have your bicycle facility. The bottom one shows where you're using express lane markers, which you can use those. Use express lane markers as a method of separation. Okay, so the types of separation: express lane markers, raised medians such as separators, on-street parking, and rigid barriers. Express lane markers can only be used if it's 35 miles per hour or less. And if it's 40 to 45 miles an hour, you need raised medians such as separators or rigid barriers. What is required for a separated bicycle facility? So what needs to happen is separation has to be maintained between the bicycle and motor vehicle traffic through intersections, no mixing zones. There has to be a minimum width of separation, and you have to minimize conflict points. Cyclists should be given a priority at the driveway and side street crossings. Okay. Some general information about lane widths and separation. If you are adjacent to on-street parking, you need 3 feet of separation. If it's 35 miles an hour or less, and you're adjacent to the travel lanes, the preferred separation is 6 feet, but 3 feet is the minimum. And you can use 2 feet if you're using express lane markers, but 6 foot is preferred. At the higher speeds of 40 to 45 miles an hour, we prefer 8 feet, but 3 feet is the minimum. So separated bike lanes can be one-way or two-way facilities. For a two-way facility, we prefer 12 feet with a 10-foot minimum, and for one-way facilities, 7 foot is preferred, but 6 foot is the minimum. So if you want more information on separated bike lane facilities, the FHWA guide is a good resource. So sharrows. Sharrows are a type of bicycle facility. They're shared lane markings. Are optional pavement markings used to indicate a shared environment for the bicyclist and motor vehicles. They're used when it's not practical to provide a bicycle facility to fill a gap in a otherwise continuous bicycle facility as part of traffic control, or when there's on-street parking. You can only use sharrows if the speed limit is 35 miles an hour or less, and the markings are placed in the center of the roadway to help the bicyclist command the lane and discourages motorists from passing too closely to the bicyclist. Sharrows should be on the pavement marked every 250 feet. All right, shared use paths. So new in 2020, the FDM language states that a shared use path may be substituted for a bicycle lane. In previous years, you had to provide a bicycle facility if you had a shared use path, a separate bicycle facility. So what is a shared use path? Shared use paths are paved facilities that are physically separated from motorized vehicular traffic by either open space or barrier and are located within right-of-way. Another name for a shared use path is a trail, and there are multiple users of shared use paths, including pedestrians, bicyclists, skaters, and runners. Okay, and since they are pedestrian facilities, they have to meet all ADA requirements. So shared use paths may substitute for bicycle lanes at speeds 35 miles per hour and greater. All right, shared use paths may also substitute for sidewalk. So new this year in the FDM, shade is one of the things that is attractive. Obviously, we live in Florida, so new in 2020, shade along shared use paths is desired. And if there is an opportunity to choose an alignment to maximize shade and minimize cost, by using existing shade from architectural sources such as buildings, pavilions, sunshades, or landscaping. So when you ever have an opportunity to maximize the shade, that is desirable. Minimal cost is also desirable. Lighting. If you're putting a shared use path in an area where there's going to be frequent night users, such as college campuses, you should consider lighting. The preferred width of a shared use path or typical width is 12 feet, but shared use paths can be 10 to 14 feet. And in constrained conditions, you can have a section for 8-foot width path. The shared use path, if your longitudinal grade is 4% or less, is 18 miles per hour. And if it's more than 4%, 30 miles per hour. So you're designing for the bicyclist speed. So bicycle lanes are typically safer and more efficient for bicyclists, but many users prefer to be off the roadway. All right, so where are you putting the shared use path? Preference would be near the right-of-way line whenever possible, outside the clear zone. You have to be at least 4 feet from the back of curb if the design speed is 45 miles per hour or less, and 5 feet from the edge of the paved shoulder for 45 miles per hour per less on a flush shoulder roadway. You have to have horizontal clearance on both sides, which is 4 feet. You have to consider drop-off hazards. 10-foot is the vertical clearance, but if you're in an equestrian area, you should have at least 12 feet for vertical clearance. Shared use paths are in contest classifications C1, C2, and C3, which is lower volume non-motorist than other contest classifications. If you're looking at a more urban setting, consider a separated bike lane with a sidewalk. And one of the reasons for that is shared use paths, we want to limit conflict points of side streets and driveways. So we don't want to have things crossing the shared use path frequently. Separation has to be maintained between the bicyclist and motorized vehicle traffic through the intersections, which means you can't put the bicyclist back on the roadway and then after the intersection have the cyclists go back on a shared use path. They have to be separated. At the same time, when you're designing it, you want to ensure adequate access to local streets and facilities. And think about when your cyclists are entering and exit the shared use path, you don't want them to go onto the street and entering conflicting traffic. Bicyclists are supposed to go in the same direction as the traffic. Okay, so these are all things to consider when you're designing. So every project is unique and has limitations. Right-of-way, drainage, frequent driveways, accommodating transit. Selecting bicycle accommodations needs to be looked at holistically given project specifications and incorporate a community's vision. And that's what I have.
I'm muted.
I unmuted you, Eric.
Okay. Staff, are there any public comments on this item?
No public comments.
Do any committee members have any comments or questions on the Florida Design Manual updates? Again, right, I think we're getting the knack of this. Raised hand in the Zoom app. Wait to be recognized or waving your hand.
I do have that. Larry has his hand raised.
Okay, Larry's first.
Yeah, on behalf of FDOT, I thought Chris did an excellent job with the presentation. Scott or Chris, do you have any update if District 4 for the FDM update for shared use paths can be substituted for a bike lane? Are there any in the queue for that? Any just further discussions on that FDM update? I think it was on one of your slides. Thank you.
When you say FDM update, I'm not sure I understood the question because the FDM already does say that. The FDM is updated. Yes. If what okay. you're asking me is there any projects where that's going to happen?
Yes.
I can't think of any off the top of my head where there's been some new projects coming up where we have planned a shared use path instead of on-street bike lanes, but I can't think of any where the lanes have actually been removed from the street and put onto a path.
Okay, thanks, Scott.
Chair, I do have that. Ted has his hand raised.
Okay, Ted.
Hi, Chair. Actually, I wanted to say thank you for wanting to get this done and get this type of presentation. It was very good. I used to ride, before I lost my sight, about 7,000 to 8,000 miles a year. And fortunately, where I was not like riding on Okeechobee, which is where I live off of now. But this was a great presentation, and I think it's very informative and so important. That's it.
Okay, thanks, Ted. Who do we have next, Margie?
Sorry, I have to unmute myself. I have Bob has his hand raised.
Okay, Bob.
Well, I thought this was a great presentation and a whole lot of stuff to try to understand. And I'm going to have to go back and read it and think about it an awful lot. I think they were saying that you should not try to go from a bike lane to a shared use a path and then back again, or you should try to avoid that. Is that true? To me, one of the things that's kind of needed in a lot of designs is realization that you are probably going to go from a bike lane to a shared use path and come back. You know, that transition is one that's not there very often. I don't remember seeing anything like it. And I've seen a lot of projects where, you know, you could, in order to get to off of the bike lane and onto the side of the road, you've got a curb to go over. You got to stop. You got to be. I mean, it's really a very difficult transition to make. And I think we should really think hard about those. And I think the whole approach here is really interesting. Thanks.
Thank you.
I don't see any more hands raised. I just want to make, Brian. Fadi. Oh, you guys are
first.
Trying to trick me. Brian was first.
Okay. Brian.
Yeah. I'll have a good number of questions, so just stop me if I'm going overboard. Thank you, first of all, to Chris and the whole FDOT team for coming and doing this presentation. I know in terms of bike facilities, you're doing really absolutely awesome things and working on this stuff, and really appreciate the steps that we're making. I have some technical questions and some, I guess, maybe more questions about the future of where this continues to go. So I saw on the shared use paths recommended, well, the design speed for the pit trails were 18 miles per hour. Is that shared for protected bicycle facilities as well? You have an 18 mile per hour design speed.
Scott, do you know off the top of your head?
Yes, I think I can answer it. The reason that the shared has a design speed such as 18 or 30 is it's generally separated from the roadway, and we want to make sure that, you know, the curves and the transitions across side streets and driveways or wherever are adequate for bicyclists traveling at speed. When you have a on-street bike lane, even though it may be separated by a separator, it's generally going to follow the roadway, which is designed for a much higher speed. So it's not really specified what the design speed is for the bike facility for an on-street or separated bike lane, but it's, I think, implied or inherent that it wouldn't have the same design speed as the adjacent roadway. There wouldn't be anything sharper, you know, within that bike lane.
Okay. Thank you. Is there a process or procedure for narrowing the bike lane or marked shoulder narrower than 4 or 5 feet for those given conditions, or is that the FDOT standard for bicycle lanes and marked shoulders and on the roadways?
We will not mark a bike facility narrower than 4 feet or a 5 foot shoulder. I mean, it may be there if that's the best we can do, but we won't mark it.
Great. It's in the, I don't know if I have only briefly glanced through the FDM. Does it have anything to say about signalization for bicycles in particular? So, you know, bike signals is something that we haven't, I don't think, adopted in Palm Beach County yet. But if the occurrence were to come where we had a one-way contraflow protected bicycle lane, on a signalized roadway, the instance of, you know, a bicycle, let's say traveling north with southbound traffic, that's what, you know, a contraflow lane would be. How would that signal work for them? Does the FDM address signalization for bicyclists?
Yes, but not in the way you mentioned. It doesn't really get into the details of what you just talked about. The only mention of signalization in the FDM, which Larry keeps pushing me on, is it does mention boxes and two-step bike boxes. Are you familiar with bike boxes that allow the bikes to go ahead of the traffic waiting at the signal?
Yes.
So it does acknowledge those and allow for those, but it doesn't really get into the details of contraflow intersections or anything like that.
Okay. Yeah, we haven't had bike signals in Palm Beach County yet, but I imagine in the future they could be possible. And then I was going to ask about the 4-foot horizontal clearance as applies for trails. Is that only dealing with road rights of way, or can there be less than a 4-foot horizontal clearance for trails outside of road rights of way, such as on a rails to trail or on a canal project?
We can only control what's in our right of way, so I would say it is in our right of way.
But you're saying like on rails to trails where we don't own the trail anyway, right?
Could be. Yeah, I was just wondering.
So, I mean, this is just a DOT standard that, yeah, dictates how we will build a road within our right-of-way. So I guess you could say it doesn't apply. But I will also say, I mean, those are the standards. But if you have a project-specific condition where it's just not practical or feasible to meet all the standards, this happens on every project. We can document a variation. We still want to do the right thing and whatever the best thing. We're not going to scrap a good project because it can't meet every single criteria. So if you can't meet the 4-foot in cases and it still seems a safe facility and the right thing to do, I don't think that would be a fatal flaw.
Okay, thank you. That's all I had for now.
Okay, Eric, I had that Fadi had his hand raised.
Okay, Fadi.
Yeah, again, good presentation, and it's good to see the evolution of these guidelines. I think, you know, what Bob mentioned before, we probably have a lot of information on these various bike facilities, but we probably need more education on the transition because that's usually where we have issues. And I know you also mentioned about those conflict points, you know, with the green shading. And I've seen them on some roads, I think on State Route 7, if you go, you know, but I don't know if they're completely, I mean, if it's required or not, or just, So anyway, I think for this conflict point and for the transition, it would be great to have maybe another educational kind of session in the future just to help us better understand these issues. And again, thanks for the UT and thanks for you, Eric, for planning for that. Thank you.
Okay, Margie, who's next? Joanne?
I have Joanne.
Okay, Joanne.
Good morning, everyone. I just want to say thank you for the presentation, Chris and Larry and Scott. I'm very excited to hear about this design change. And also, I want to say thank you to Margie for sending out that information about the online course for bicycle facilities. I think it was like about a month ago. I definitely plan on taking that. It was like an online 10-hour on-demand course. So I just want to remind and share everyone about that information as well. Thank you.
Anyone else, Margie?
I don't see anybody else. I'm just going to scroll just to be sure I didn't miss anybody. Nope, I think that's it.
Okay, I'll try to be brief. I think it's probably an exciting time to be a roadway designer with these doing these new facilities. Kind of was wondering, does the district have any physically separated bike facilities in the production line coming up, raised separators?
We have. Go ahead, Chris.
No, you know more about the project.
We have one that I am aware of. It's on Lake Worth Road for a stretch. That's the only one that I am aware of at this time. They're converting, I believe, a 7-foot buffered bike lane into a separated. And I do want to emphasize now that I mentioned that we're viewing that as a pilot project, because if you go back and you review the presentation Dave, a 7-foot bike lane does not convert into a separated. The required width, minimum width for a separated facility is actually 9 feet. So we agree to do that one as a pilot to see how it goes, to get one built, but not something we're looking to replicate, you know, quickly over and over and over if we only have 7 feet. That's the one I know of right now.
Okay. Yeah, I think my quick take is some of the minimums are a little bit conservative. I'd be interested to see how that 7-foot conversion actually functions. Just a little concerned that the minimums are so wide, it's going to limit the retrofit capabilities. And then the other thing I'm kind of wondering about is it still seems that from 35 to 45, it's physically separated or is a should, and I'm wondering how, versus a conventional bike lane, how that's going to be, what the district's approach going to be. And, you know, the downside of the separator is it is, the maintenance is more difficult to keep the bike lane clean. You know, I was involved in some at West Palm Beach. I like them, but they are, as far as a street sweeper, things like that, they are more maintenance. I'm wondering kind of what your thoughts are on that.
Oh, Scott, we can't hear you.
Oh, okay. I didn't realize it was a question. So was the question, how are we going to view the separation versus traditional? Like,
right, because it's the manual still seems like, I'm sorry, the manual still, it's a kind of a gray area.
It is.
The preferred.
No, you're correct. And I think they do that intentionally to allow us the flexibility. So we want to provide the best bike facility we can. If we can fit in a separated bike facility, maintenance notwithstanding, I think we would prefer to do that. Okay. It's the reason they leave it gray, and it's just in our urban environments, there's just never seems to be enough space. They didn't want to mandate anything on us that we could never accomplish. I share your concern about the minimum widths being so big that they actually argued that we should be able to take a 7-foot bike lane and retrofit it to a separated. That argument, they won't make the standard say that, but it's not to say, but then again, they said, hey, in your district, you can make your own decisions on a project specific level, which is why we decided to proceed with the one pilot on Lake Worth Road. So yeah, we would prefer to have a separated bike facility, space permitting.
Okay. Great. Are there any more questions? This is a big change for the bike facilities. I'm really, really happy the manual's been updated. With that, I'm going to move on. Thank you, Scott and Chris.
Thank you.
Thank you.
Okay. Item D, 2019 Performance Measures Report Card. Andrew is going to present this item.
Thank you. Thank you. And I know we're running long, so I want to make it quick. This is going to be the performance measures for 2019. And our performance measures is how we track our long-range transportation plan goals and objectives, which is based off of our vision of a safe, efficient, and connected multimodal transportation system. I think we're still setting up here. And with these, I just want to mention that this presentation isn't really that accessible. There's a lot of pictures in here of the chart, but I really only have a few highlights to go through. So the first one is preservation, and I only have one highlight here is we have showing a interstate pavement condition that is much lower than our previous year. So right now we have 2018 pavement numbers in, and in 2017 we had 55% pavement in good condition, and now we have 23% pavement in good condition for the interstate. The reason for this is we just talked to FDOT about it. They actually introduced a new way of measuring pavement condition and using new technology for
the rutting and cracking of the roadway, that which is required by the federal government. So that is why we have a updated number that's so much lower than the old way we were calculating it. This is also going to be the same for national highway system that aren't on the interstate. So in the future, we may see that number go down as well. The next one we have as a category is safe, so a safe system. And we have established a Vision Zero target for Palm Beach TPA. We only have preliminary numbers in for 2019, but those preliminary numbers for 2019 for the number of fatalities, the rate of fatalities, and then also serious injuries in the rate are showing an improvement over 2018 values. However, those numbers aren't finalized. I looked recently, and they do look like they're a little bit higher now, based on some of the resources out there from Signal 4 Analytics, who tracks crash data. And so our number of fatalities is from 2018 was 186, and will probably end up more closely to 170 in 2019. So that's still an improvement, which is good. Hopefully it stays around that many fatalities. And we're seeing similar numbers for serious injuries, where it did go down a little bit. I'm showing on the screen a graph of fatal crashes by month. And this is just an update for 2019 and 2020. And it goes to the month of March, because that is not available for April and May from the Signal 4 Analytics report. But we are seeing a total amount of fatal crashes going down for the month of March. So in 2019, we had 20. And now in March of 2020, we have 7. So not all the numbers are in, but it is looking like we do have a reduction in the amount of fatal crashes, which is good to see. The next one is an efficient system. So how reliable is our transportation system and how productive is our transit network? The one takeaway from this is that we do see some good reliability measures for the interstate and the non-interstate national highway system. They're staying pretty steady so far for 2018 values compared to the previous years. And then for productivity, these numbers did change a little bit, but they're similar to the old numbers. So for Tri-Rail service, we have passenger trips per revenue hour, which declined a little bit over the previous year. And then Palmtran fixed route service went up a little bit. So they improved a little bit on productivity for Palmtran service, and then Tri-Rail had a little bit of a lower service for 2018. When the new 2019 numbers are released, I would expect to see a better increase for Tri-Rail. They just, before the coronavirus issues, they were experiencing their record ridership numbers for their months. So that 2019 number should be promising when it comes out. And here's one that's more focused for you all, for having a connected transportation system. So we track how many miles of bicycle and pedestrian facilities we have out there on our federal aid eligible system. And we track separated bike lanes, shared use pathways, 8 to 9 foot paved pathways, buffered bike lanes, designated bike lanes, and sidewalks. We did see a large improvement for the facilities out there from our local initiatives of transportation alternatives program, especially for shared use pathways. So we were at 83 miles of shared use pathways in 2019, which is an increase of 11 miles over 2018. And then we have a few other miles added to our designated bike lanes, the amount of sidewalks, and then also the 8 to 9 foot paved pathways. Also with Connected, we track those same measures for pedestrian bicycle facilities, but how in relation to transit hubs, to elementary schools, and to also a quarter mile of traditionally underserved communities. No big updates here. We did see a slight improvement in the amount of pedestrian facilities within 1/4 mile of a traditionally underserved community for 2019. So it jumped around 3% total to 71%. And lastly, this is my last one for multimodal. And it's really, there's mode splits, but the mode splits for walking, bicycling, and transit, the new numbers for 2019 won't be released until the end of this year. We use Census American Community Survey for those numbers. And they usually stay pretty steady. But in the previous year for 2018, we saw a slight reduction in commuter mode split for walking, an increase for biking, and then transit went down. Those numbers do have some margin of error. And so year to year, you're usually working within the margin of error. So we really care more about that long term over a couple of years to really see some impacts there. It's been staying pretty steady around those numbers, though, fluctuating just a little bit year to year for the past decade or more. For freight, we track the annual tonnage of freight for Port of Palm Beach and then Palm Beach International Airport. And our 2019 numbers are seeing reduction in annual tonnage for freight for the Port of Palm Beach, but we did see an increase for Palm Beach International Airport. And that's really my last point I wanted to make. In this presentation, I mentioned 2018 numbers and 2019 numbers. A lot of the data comes out different times throughout the year. So we're going to be keeping this updated on our website, and we're trying to make it more interactive in the near term, future here, so you guys can get more out of it. And so we'll keep it updated when a new data is released, so you guys can always track it online. It'll be updated at all times. That's it.
Thank you, Andrew. Staff, are there any public comments on this item?
No, Mr. Chair.
Okay. Do any committee members have any comments or questions? Let's see, Fatty's there, got his hand up. Fatty.
Yeah, I just want to provide some data that the county is tracking. You know, we start tracking traffic volumes toward the middle of March. Now, on March 17, which is probably the midweek, we had about 22% less traffic than compared to a year before. On March 25th, it went down to 40%, and then the following week to 43%, and in April went down to 47%, and now start coming back again. Last week it was 44%, in fact 2 weeks ago, and last week it was 40%, and we expected going up also this week. Now, what's interesting, we compared the crash data we had for the last 2 weeks of March compared to the year before, and we had about 43% less crashes compared to 40% reduction in traffic. So this is the data I want to share with you.
Thank you, Fatty. Margie, anybody else?
I don't see anybody else.
Okay. Being there's no other questions or comments, we're going to move on. Thank you, Andrew, for the report card. Item E, TPA operating procedures. Is that right? Andrew's back again.
I'm back.
Okay.
This will be brief. So the TPA governing board adopted operating procedures, which now take the place of the committee bylaws. So originally we had all of our bylaws in separate documents, but now we have it consolidated into one document called TPA operating procedures. And also in this adoption, there's an inclusion of new sections, one addressing emergency powers, and then one addressing amendments to the operating procedures. So the first section there that we added was the 6.2 virtual meetings. So this is only applicable when TPA board or committee is unable to meet in person and is permitted by law, executive order, or similar action to conduct a meeting with a virtual quorum. And this authorizes virtual meetings using communications media technology. So today we're using the Zoom platform. And then we're also still providing opportunities for public comment. So there's the ability to for people to raise their hands to be called on for public comment. And then also there's an online form that people can fill out to submit their public comments for all the agenda items. The next section added was section 6.3, the emergency powers. And this is only applicable when the TPA board is unable to meet in person and is also unable to meet virtually and must take an immediate action to approve or amend an essential document. So if they were going to look into doing this, the TPA chair would make this action upon consultation with executive director and TPA general counsel. And then if an action was taken to meet this, it requires a presentation of the action at the next TPA board meeting for public input, and then the board endorsement or modification. And then the next section added was just amendments to the operating procedures. So this establishes the process for future amendments. And it states that draft amendment must be included on an agenda item on the agenda. And then modifications to draft amendment that occur at the board meeting do not require a re-noticing. And that's all I have.
Great. Thank you, Andrew. Staff, are there any public comments on this item?
No, Mr. Chair.
Okay. Any committee members have any comments or questions on the operating procedures?
I don't see any hands raised.
I don't either, Margie. So being that there's no comments or questions, we're going to move on. Section 4, administrative items, member comments. Are there any member comments? I am going to, if there's no other member comments, I have one item to note. Margie, do you see any raised hands?
I don't see any raised hands. You're okay.
The ad hoc Greenway Scoring Committee that got delayed with COVID. So we're going to work on, I'll work with staff getting some dates to have that committee meet. We'd like to have that input from the committee prior to October when we select when the governing board selects is that the date, staff? Kind of when we'd have to have a recommendation in place, the critical deadline?
Yes, in October, the committees and board will adopt the scoring for next year. The board will adopt it and the committees will recommend adoption.
And I think looks like a lot of the Greenway Scoring Committee members aren't here today too. Subcommittee, the ad hoc committee. So we're going to work on that. No other member comments? Okay. Item B, summary points from the April 16th, 2020 governing board meeting. Staff it's in your agenda packet. And if staff is available to answer questions about it.
And we didn't receive any public comments on that item.
Okay, on the summary points or on the member comments?
No, on the summary points. We didn't receive any public comments. I'm sorry.
Okay. No. So we have no comments on the summary points. Item C, TPA priority project status report. This item was provided in the agenda packet, and staff is here to answer your questions, but there's no presentation planned. We start with, are there any public comments on this, staff?
No, Mr. Chair.
Okay. Is there any members have any questions for staff?
I don't see any hands raised.
Okay, as a reminder, next meeting is June 4th, 2020. Note that we have another BPAC meeting today at 1:30 to receive presentations from the Transportation Alternative Funding Program applications, the meeting agenda, and how to access the meeting, please visit palmbeachtpa.org/BTPAC. Our next regular committee meeting is scheduled for June 4th, and we'll provide information in the near future regarding where and how the meeting will be conducted. Thank you for your patience with us as we conducted our first virtual BTPAC meeting today. I think it went pretty well. Again, I'm going to thank staff. I could tell a lot of work went into this. It went smooth. So, I think it went pretty well for our first one. So the meeting, I'd like to adjourn the meeting. Is there a motion?
You don't need a motion. You can just adjourn.
Okay. So I'll see everyone back at 1:30.
Yes, to clarify, you will have a separate Zoom meeting, and everyone should have received a separate panelist link. If you didn't receive it, just send me an email or give me a call and I'll resend it to you.
The Mark, next one. Do you want to join 10 minutes early again to test?
Yes, just to get settled and tested, and then you can toggle your video and audio on and off as needed.
Okay, adjourned.